Hi, this is Heather Esposito, and this is Leadership by Design. Welcome to today's episode of Leadership by Design. Today's guest is Diana Anderson, who's a master certified coach and the CEO of Cilient and the creator of Cilient System for instilling coaching cultures where people feel safe, seen, and supported to realize their potential. Her untying the knot approach to in-the-moment coaching and feedback that Diana has created has given thousands of people worldwide the practical skills they need to turn everyday conversations into opportunities to help others learn from their day-to-day challenges, create connections, and inspire people to take action. Forbes calls Diana a pioneer in the creation of coaching cultures. She recognized the transformational power of coaching as a leadership style in the early 90s when she began her coaching career. Diana is one of the first graduates from Coach University and a founding member of the International Coach Federation. That's pretty amazing that you are a founding member of this group, and I'm excited to have you on the podcast today, Diana.
Oh, Heather, so great to be here. Thanks so much. Yeah, you know, we had no idea that coaching would turn into what it has become. In fact, one of the questions I remember at the very first ICF conference was, do you think this will catch on?
Well, I think we have the answer to that. I don't think you can read any leadership literature without understanding the importance of coaching and being able to have a coaching conversation when it comes to developing people. So,
yeah, absolutely. We just had no idea back in the 90s.
Mission accomplished. We still got work to do, though. As much as we've done, it feels like there's still such an unlimited horizon in front of us about what this could become for organizations.
Yeah. And for the world, I completely agree. I completely agree. Yeah.
Well, this, we've been kind of doing a series with understanding change. I mean, so much change is happening in the world, change is happening within organizations. And so right now I've been talking to thought leaders and subject matter experts on this concept of change. Yet in your bio, we definitely hear this strong emphasis on coaching. So what does coaching have to do with this concept of change?
Oh, well, coaching has everything to do with change, everything. Because here's the thing, what coaching does is actually help people to change their behavior. It is, you know, the alchemy, it's the thing that helps people change. And if you think about the kinds of change that are most important right now, so whether it's, you know, creating a more equitable culture or even just reimagining our supply systems, everything that we're doing that's of most significance involves people changing their behavior at scale. And that's what coaching does really, really well. In fact, that's what inspired me to make In the Moment Coaching. You know, I don't mention it in my bio there, but my background actually before I became a coach in the 90s was in large scale change management. And, you know, I often tell people that what happened when I moved into coaching was I noticed that it didn't matter who I was coaching, whether it was, you know, a more senior person or more junior person or anybody, I was just always coaching people to take a coaching approach to their day-to-day challenges, which is, you know, what change is full of, right? And what I noticed was that when people took a coaching approach by getting curious or asking a question or sharing an observation, that every kind of human-based change, which is the foundation of any kind of structural change for the most part, happened more quickly and easily and successfully. And that's what inspired me to create our untying the knot approach to in-the-moment coaching, because I knew that if people could do this day in and day out, that all kinds of change would be easier and more successful.
So what came first? Did you were doing the change management and you got exposed to coaching, or you were already doing things that were coach-like and then realized there was a name for it? How did that work?
Yeah, no, well, I the real story, I'm originally from Canada. I did an MBA. I got hired by an American consulting firm. And back in the 90s, we were re-engineering everything. So I got hired on a big, you know, international team to actually re-engineer like Fortune 100 divisions. So we were like massive, but technical oriented change. But what I noticed pretty quickly was it changed, you know, changing things was actually relatively easy. We had a very simple process for it, but it was changing the people where things really got sticky, right? And so, you know, I saw that, I experienced that. And then, you know, I got married, left consulting, you know, and was looking for what was next. And the truth was, I happened to open up probably one of the very, very, I was living in Houston, opened the newspaper one day, and I saw what I think is probably one of the very first descriptions of coaching as we would now know it today. And when I read that, I'm like, oh, that was, you know, it was so intriguing to me. And it sounded kind of like the consulting we had been doing. So that's why I signed up for, you know, to get trained as a coach. And so like, I'm one of the very first graduates from Coach University, and that Coach University actually created the ICF. And so when I started coaching, that's when I kind of put the connection together and went, oh, this is what helps people change. We all have to do this.
And in one of the past episodes we did where Lauren was a guest, and you know Lauren,
yeah,
and it's part of the foundation of how we approach leadership development here at MillerKnoll, is basically what you were talking about. There's like technical solutions for technical challenges. Mm-hmm. We need adaptive solutions for adaptive challenges, things that require us to change a mindset, change a belief, change assumptions that we have. And those things are pretty core to who we are, how we see the world. And changing those is not as simple as implementing, like you said, a simple technical solution. And so many times we see people trying to put technical solutions on adaptive challenges and wondering why it doesn't work. And that just reinforced what we had talked about in that particular episode and how we approach leadership development.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. And often when I see change fail, I think one of the biggest failures is because there's a confluence of these two things, that leaders have an expectation that changing people is going to be the same as changing a thing. So they're like, well, we had a plan, and we gave them one exposure to a new way of thinking, and now they haven't changed. So the problem must be the thing we taught them was wrong, you know, not that, oh, people actually change in a really different way, you know, that the risk for a human being to engage in significant behavior change is very different than, you know, coding a system to do something differently, or even, you know, like going through the logic of creating a system that's going to be more efficient. And as a result, I think, you know, because we don't think about the difference between changing things and changing people, we don't accommodate and we don't plan for the system that we need to change behavior change, or to change human behavior. And as a result, we often don't get the kind of results we're hoping for, or more frankly, need right now.
This is a really nice add-on to Dr. Andreas Hofbauer, who was our last guest, who was talking about the risk to people in making change and why, you know, we need social redundancy. We need social proof that making a change is going to be okay, and that I'm not putting myself at personal risk by adopting something that could be unpopular or could put me into an out-group. So this is a nice follow-on episode to that. So let's dig into that a little bit more. What are some of the common pitfalls that you see organizations make when they're approaching a change initiative or a culture shift and things like that, besides just this idea of changing people is the same as changing a thing?
Yeah, so a number of them, I guess. I would say what we like to say is that if you're looking at changing people, changing a culture, we have to understand why people change. And so people change for three reasons. One, they believe that they personally will benefit by doing something differently. All right. But what that personal benefit is actually, you know, unique to them. So could be that they will, you know, gain something that's of value to them. It may be that they value the company and they have value for the benefit that it will derive for others. So, but people need to believe they're going to benefit. They also need to feel that they can be successful at attaining the benefit. So often what happens is, even though people see they could, you know, land in a better place, if they don't feel that they have the skills or the support to attain that benefit, they're not going to try. And the third piece is, are they going to get rewarded for it? You know, again, this has to do with the risk reward, you know, equation, which is, if the risk of doing something is greater than the potential reward that they would receive, again, they're not going to change. So I think one of the things that when we are thinking about change as a system, we also need to think about how we are going to guide and support the human behavior change that goes with that system in a thoughtful way, and with as much, you know, kind of dedication of resources as we put into changing the technical elements of something. And I think those are often way out of balance. And that's why sometimes I think things fail.
I mean, those three things, as I think about that, like you said, that personal benefit is so unique. I mean, sometimes it may be a group benefit or a team benefit or something I'm excited about being part of because I think it's going to be meaningful or impactful. But how do you, let's just break these apart. How would a leader who's trying to help an individual see how this could be of benefit to them, like, go about that?
Well, I think on the individual basis, this is where coaching can be really, really helpful because that's the coaching conversation. You know, it's getting curious about how that person sees the worldview. So one of the things that, you know, I think and that we teach as a fundamental element of coaching is worldview and the idea that each of us has our own unique window into the world. And I think that those worldviews are created by all the experiences people have had in a lifetime. And so if you're a leader and you want to inspire someone, if you don't have a sense of what their worldview is, well, you know, you don't have really much of a hope of connecting with them around something that's meaningful. And I would point towards this moment in time because we, you know, having all of us gone through the pandemic, each in our own unique way, have each had our worldviews reshaped. And I think what I'm observing is that a lot of values have shifted, and what's important to people has shifted. And I think it's really important, not only individually, but collectively, to check in and see where people are at. I would actually point towards, you know, the Great Resignation is just a rethinking of our worldview and people sort of like looking at the equation of what it's costing them to be in a job and what their, you know, how their values have changed and whether they're getting something that's of value. And those equations, you know, it's not coming out as in a positive for a lot of people. So I think individually it's important, but I think collectively, if we want to create spaces that, you know, people want to change and move into, we've got to get really curious about how the worldview has shifted again for an individual, but also on a broader scale, so that we can create places that people want to be in and feel valued in.
And it feels like we've just as a society started moving more and more away from that, meaning it seems that we're less curious about people's worldviews and I'll use the word addicted, but more addicted to our own or trying to understand someone else's through our own. Meaning, like, because I believe mine is right, yours must be wrong. So I'm interpreting yours through the way I'm holding on to mine versus letting mine go temporarily to really try and understand yours. Do you see that as well?
Yeah, I do. And I think it's, if you were to look at a source of some of our greatest challenges, it's the polarity that creates. That makes it so hard to change because if people just, you know, take a stance and aren't willing to get curious, not only about each other's worldviews, but even about a shared possibility, like maybe neither of us is right. You know, maybe what we need to reimagine is something, you know, that sort of finds a new expression of common ground. But step one is actually being willing to get curious about each other's worldviews. And I think in some ways that's also, I would point towards it being a lack of skill. You know, I think, in our Coaching in the Moment workshop, I've taught worldview for to thousands of people. And I noticed that when people are just fundamentally made aware of the idea of worldview and given some basic skills on how to get curious about somebody else's worldview, that it actually really, you know, opens their mind to new possibilities. That's a place to begin. I think if we're going to begin to try to bring some of these big divides together that you're pointing towards, I think we just have to, as a beginning, give people the skills they need to begin to have a really different kind of conversation.
And is this a good time to bring in, I know we talked about it in your bio briefly, but this approach you have called untying the knots. And one of the things that really attracted me to your approach is that memorable sticky way of thinking about the knots that we encounter in our conversations.
Yeah. So that was an approach that I created years ago when I saw how valuable taking a coaching approach to any conversation was, I really challenged myself to create a simple, fast way that anybody in the world, in any part of the organization, could quickly pick up, learn, and immediately use in a practical way. And through years of work, I came up with untying the knot. And the idea is that, you know, we all experience certain kinds of knots. And that when we get curious about what people are not aware of, or, you know, what their skills they might be lacking, we're better able to focus our conversation on the things that are stuck. So that's what we teach people, in a structured way, in coaching in the moment. Yeah,
I think that's very powerful, especially when you're getting curious about somebody's worldview. To think about each time I ask a question and understand something different, it loosens the knot, if you will. And, you know, it's not about trying to convince, to pull somebody to one side or the other, but it's about just really the untangling of all of that.
Exactly. It gives a great visual in terms of where the conversation's going. And what I find also is the greatest power of untying the knot is the more people who learn to speak this, it literally becomes a language that can help people across any boundary or any border talk about where things are stuck or they're not seeing something. Because it's not just people that have knots, projects have knots, or, you know, how divisions, work together, they have knots. In fact, one of my favorite stories around that kind of shows the power of this is I once taught a workshop, and there were two heads of divisions. So both of the heads were in the class, and these two people had a lot of knots between the two of them. All right. They were not working well. And that was actually echoing through their entire divisions. Like the divisions didn't work well because the leaders didn't work well. This story was shared with me later, but apparently they went through untying or the Coaching in the Moment class, sat down together and said, you and I, we have knots. And they used that language to understand why they were disconnecting and why they were having so many challenges working more, successfully together. And they were able to resolve them. That not only changed the relationship between these two leaders, but the entire divisions then started working more effectively together and untying knots together. So that shared language allows us to kind of talk about sticky things in a clean and effective way. And that's what makes change happen, right? When we can talk about it.
Yeah, that also reminds me of some of the stories from the sports world about sometimes people they're not as much a fan of their own team as they are that they're more banded about their antipathy of some other team, and that's what unites them versus just their love or their support for their team. But it's this collective hatred of another team that is, and that's what it sounds like to me in these two divisions, that they had actually become more about against each other than what they were working towards holistically.
Yeah, I don't know. I think what you're pointing towards for me is how our stories can be so ingrained and entrenched.
Yes.
And if we don't have a way, so all stories are built on assumptions and beliefs. Yep. And we often lack the skill to sort of like literally unearth that assumption or belief and go, wow, is that really still true? And I think that's what coaching, when it is practiced as a leadership style and a language and a way of life, allows us to do. It really allows us to unearth sometimes really old assumptions and beliefs that we didn't even know were informing, the choices that we're making or the way we see the world, and go, huh, you know what? I think that one's time is done. Let's make a new one. By the way, which is what I really think is happening in the world right now today. I'm shifting gears in you a little bit, but when I look out and see all the things that are happening, the Great Resignation and a lot of these other challenges that we're having, as we're starting to come out of the pandemic, I would say that our worldviews got so changed and our worlds got so changed by what happened, what we've been through collectively together, that in some ways the past is gone. Like, we can't go back to where we were, but we're noticing a lot of the assumptions and beliefs that we had that we didn't even think about before. Like, what do we value in work? And what do we value about each other? These things are shifting. And I think that's why it's so important to take a coaching approach to conversations now, because there's like a looseness in our collective worldview right now. Like we're all, everything's getting rewired and changed. It's a great way to get, or a great time to get really curious about some of those old assumptions and beliefs and plant new ones. But we need to be thoughtful about how we do that.
Yeah, I think the thing that I feel is most powerful about coaching overall is that ability to help build new awareness for people, mm-hmm. just things that they were blind to or didn't even realize that was driving a lot of their story. And we can take it to things about what we value, or take it even to very concrete things like what we believed about how work got done, that we had to be in an office, and that if people weren't in an office, they wouldn't be productive. Well, like, we didn't even get a chance to philosophically make that adjustment. We were forced into that overnight and quickly blew that assumption out of the water. People were actually more productive and working harder as a result of that, is what the data was showing. And so it's interesting now, as organizations try and figure out what the new is going to be, how do they balance what the value was in being in the office and the connection and collaboration that came from that, and really still fundamentally understanding how work gets done, or where place plays a role in getting that done. What's the value of the physicality of the space to what you're trying to accomplish?
Yes. All fantastic questions. And let me just say that taking a coaching approach to answering them is what's going to help us come to really good new conclusions. Mm-hmm. Because, our old leadership style is more about arguing, this is right, this is wrong, this is good, this is bad, and then we get stuck, we get polarized. But what coaching really supports, and what's so important right now, is what I would call iterative learning. It's like we come up with an idea. It's like, well, maybe working in this way will be great, but we don't know. So we're going to go out and try. We're going to give it a go, and then we're going to come back but we're going to take a coaching approach to that conversation. We're going to say, hey, what worked? What did not work? See, knots. A knot is basically just something that's not happening.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if we said, well, what did we like? And what do we not like? Okay. Oh, so the knot, that's what we want to focus our coaching attention on. Okay. well, what's possible? Because that's what coaching asks, right? What's possible? We take a coaching approach to explore more about what we did not like about that. Maybe we did not like some, you know, part of the celebration or disconnect about something, or maybe, you know, it could be anything, but we wouldn't know till we talked about it. And then we try again. And it's that iterative kind of circular, you know, talk, try. I call it, you know, insight into action. That's actually the engine that drives coaching. It's the aha of learning something new, and then the action of going and trying it out, and then learning again, and then trying it. That is the engine that drives change. And that's basically the engine that coaching puts in place, is insight into action as a learning tool.
And when we can discover something for ourselves, it's always a much more powerful insight than, to your point, when somebody just tells us that this is the way it's going to be and this is why that's important. That experimentation, that trying, the learning for myself, when I discover that, I own it. You know, when I discover it for myself, I don't, the other person owns it when they give it to me.
Exactly.
You just don't get bought in the same way, which leads us back to the change discussion about wanting to be part of the change and believing, like I was going to circle back to the second point about believing that we can be successful at obtaining the benefit. Mm-hmm. That feels very connected to that coaching approach and that self-discovery.
Yes, absolutely. And because it also allows us to be successful in a way that's meaningful to us, which is, I think, what you're pointing towards. And exactly to the point you're making, I wish I could have caught this old research piece that came up, but I remember once reading research that someone had done that said, if you tell somebody what to do, they actually want to do it less. Even if they wanted to do it before you told them, once you tell them, they actually have less desire to do it than before. Whereas, you know, what you're saying, if you ignite the insight of, oh, you know, this is going to be beneficial for me, we actually harness that, our innate desire, you know, to attain something that's important to us. And the difference in energy that's released, you know, like one's a negative, one a positive, is huge in terms of any kind of change you want to make.
Well, and I'm personally somebody who's pretty high in my need for autonomy. So if somebody gives me the idea or tells me how to do it, I feel like this is just me talking. If I feel like it was successful, but was it successful because of my execution, or was it successful because it was your idea? And mm-hmm. I don't, to your point of that risk reward, it does not feel as rewarding to me because I lost some of the personal investment in it. Whereas if you said, Heather, here's what we're trying to accomplish, this is what it would look like if it's successfully executed, you go figure out how to get there and what mm-hmm. the approach you think should be. 9 times out of 10, I will over deliver for you because I want to get to that success metric and more. Mm-hmm. And when it is successful, I feel on top of the world because
sure.
I had the chance to bring my best or bring the value that I think I can offer that's unique. So
yeah. And what you just described is the power of human potential. Right. That's what coaching releases. It's, and I'm just going to talk about needing energy in the world. The most untapped source of energy in the entire world is human potential.
Oh, 100%.
And, you know, the more we actively work in ways that encourage people to tap into it and create safe spaces, by the way, you know, where people feel like they can really try new things, think new things, connect in new ways, the more that potential comes online. And I actually just wrote an article on how coaching cultures unravel complexity. And, you know, what I was pointing towards is, if you think about, probably if you looked at like the top 3 or 5 goals or objectives that your organization has, the chances are that they're extremely complex. Like most of the really cut and dry, simple things to solve, that we solved those. The stuff that we're really left with are highly complex things, you know, like that involve a lot of behavior change. And the more we can bring human potential, the more we can bring people's curiosity and a sense of possibility to thinking about probably, you know, completely new ways of addressing these things, the more quickly we're going to move through them. So it's in our shared best interest to actually really think about how we bring human potential and creativity online as a way of life in our organizations, because the stuff we've got to solve will require it.
That aligns perfectly with one of our leadership principles, which is unlock potential. We have three key leadership principles. One is to inspire impact. One is to unlock potential. And one is to cultivate connection. So
love it.
Those are our three key leadership principles. Of course, there's three practices or three behaviors under each one, but we believe that unlocking potential, not only in the leader themselves for them to take on their own development as job one, but also to unlock the potential of their teams is one of the key things that leaders can focus on. So that aligns perfectly.
Yeah. That's beautiful and beautifully articulated.
Thank you.
Yeah, really nice.
And they're natural extensions of the values of our organization. So if we believe people are extraordinary, which is one of our values, then a leader's role is to unlock that potential.
That's just a whole coaching worldview right there. I mean, that's how I would express it, really.
Yeah,
it's, you know, believing in possibility, you know. Yeah.
Inspires me. I mean, like that's why I like doing the work that I do, is because leaders to me have such an amazing influence. They are entrusted with a team of people. And if that's not one of the key things that we're doing, is trying to unlock potential, grow and develop that talent, then to me, we're missing the mark as leaders. It's not just about managing the work. It's about bringing out the best in each person you have the privilege of leading.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that is the leadership of, I was going to say the future, but I'm going to say now. Like in this moment, we have such potential to create really foundational change. And it will require exactly the kind of leadership that you just described, Heather. Because it will be in changing people that we will change the systems. And I don't think anything changes a system faster than changing what people believe it means to be a good and effective leader. I mean, leadership is really that profound. And I love that you guys are articulating it the way that you are. That's beautiful.
Yeah, businesses don't transform, people do.
Exactly.
But when people do, businesses can transform.
Exactly, yeah.
So kind of back to this third point really quickly, when someone sees the risk as greater than the reward and there's resistance to the change, what are some of the ways that a leader can show up or some skills they can gain to help people over that challenge? Because I think that's one of the areas where we often get stuck, that we don't know how to help someone through a resistance to change.
Mm-hmm. So I would tell you that resistance is always just a sign of fear. Right?
Oh, I love that.
And I think the very first thing that leaders can do when someone is resisting is just full stop, open up your curiosity and ask, what might this person be afraid of? You know, do they not see the benefit? Are they afraid they're not going to be successful at moving through this change? Do they feel that if they make the change, they're putting themselves at risk in some way? And ask yourself then, leader, how might I be contributing to this fear?
Oh, that's the hard one.
Right. But here's the thing.
That's the self. Yeah.
Here's the fingers
pointing back at me.
Uh-huh. Our traditional approaches to leadership. So the stuff that most of us have been taught it means to be a good and effective leader is all fear-based. It's, if you really look at it in its essence, the essence of what we've often been taught is that you have to control and compel people to comply. I mean, that in essence, most of what we're doing is that. And the mechanism for doing that is fear. You know, whether you articulate, here's the consequence, or whether it's just subtly implied, when we try to use fear to compel compliance, we get resistance. And when we stop using fear and instead rely on igniting insight that's supported by a more compassionate approach to leadership, we unleash potential. And that's why changing what people believe it means to be a good and effective leader is the thing that changes all things. But when you are facing resistance, ask yourself these questions and then notice what it happens when you do that at scale.
Okay, so can you repeat those questions? I know the big zinger was, how am I contributing to this? But what were the other questions?
Well, so if you think about the three things that cause people to change, then the three things that would cause them not to change are the opposite, right?
Mm. Okay, so, yep.
So they were kind of just the opposite of that, which is, does this, you know, so if the person's resisting, they're frightened. So they either don't see how they're going to benefit, like, what's in it for me? More often what's going on is they don't feel like they have the skills or the support to successfully make the transition that's being asked for them. Or the third one is they feel the risk of actually making the change is not ever going to be near the reward. Like, they will put themselves at risk. It's like, I'd love to try this new thing, but if I'm the only one doing it, you know, and I don't see you doing it, by the way, Mr. Leader or Mrs. Leader, you know? Yep. You're asking me to do something, but I don't see you doing it. And I don't see anybody else around me doing it. So the risk for me to make that change is profound. So there's a lot of things wired into that. And then the question is, you know, on, if you're looking on an individual basis, you have to ask yourself as a leader, how A, am I contributing to that fear? And B, what can I use to begin to mitigate it?
I just put myself personally in that, like, I don't want to admit how I might be contributing to that, or, to be able to look at, especially when I do my coaching, this is something I see a lot is, well, that's not my intent. And we mistake that our intent mirrors the impact that we're having. And so I want to explain away how I might be contributing, because that wasn't my intent. Like, that's the excuse I can use to excuse myself, if you will.
Right. And I guess here's the thing is, I wish we could. So that idea of needing to excuse yourself is also another expression of fear.
Yeah.
Like, exactly. I will be wrong. And so that's why I kind of keep pointing back to the collective, because I think it's hard for individual leaders to fully embody what I'm talking about if we haven't thought about a system for instilling it as a way of life that makes it safe for everyone to change. And by the way, you don't need everyone. You need 25%, you know, of people to adopt, you know, a new approach to doing something differently for it to become safe for everybody. So anyway, it's, you know, on an individual basis, certainly important, but collectively is where you, really unleash the potential of an organization.
And looking at it from like a 25% to really start to move the needle, that feels achievable.
It is.
Yeah,
it is, but you've got to provide people with the safety to make the change. Okay. So it's not like 25% scattered throughout the organization.
Correct.
It's,
yeah.
You know, it's again, a system of people connecting with each other, a system of supporting people to make the behavior change over time, a system of rewarding the, you know, engaging in the new behavior. You've got to think about it like that. I mean, here's the thing I would tell you. When I watch organizations go through like a SAP transition, or even like what we used to do to re-engineering, we brought massive numbers of people and sometimes millions of dollars to change systems. But when it comes to changing people, we think we're going to put them through a class and that's somehow going to do it. But leadership and human behavior are systems as well. And they really require and need thought and support in order to change it. And it actually changing human behavior is harder than changing technical systems, not easier.
I agree with that. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, I think it's a mind shift that we all need to kind of get our heads around. And then I think we can think about it in a new and refreshed way.
And especially when it comes to the coaching culture that we've been working to create, I would say that, like, we have approached that from a systems perspective and really tried to think about the longitudinal piece of that. Like, you can't just put somebody through a coaching class and expect them to do something differently. There's like the, I'll just call it the HR ecosystem and infrastructure that goes around to the rewards and how we're talking about it, how we're reinforcing the skill. And then there's the ongoing communities of learning. What other things, I mean, you've brought this idea of system up a number of times. What else goes into a complete system, I guess?
Well, I have, you know, my initial thoughts, what you've described, certainly a big part of it. I think part of it is actually working with our leaders to reimagine what leadership really means. It sounds like you guys are doing a really nice job of that. But I think when we change our story about what it means to be a good and effective leader, then the rest of it starts to happen more naturally. So a lot of the reinforcement that you talked about, I think certainly the rewards piece of it, you know, are we rewarding people for changing behavior? But here, you know, the one thing I would, so I think we're going to take a coaching approach to this. And I think we're going to discover, you know, more elements of this as we get deeper into it. But the one thing that really popped for me when I was, I think I shared with you, I was reading some research by Damon Santola on how human behavior change. And what really struck for me was how difficult it is for the most senior leaders to change, that the risk for people who have a lot of, a strong reputation, the risk for them to change is huge. And frequently the amount of support that they have.
I was going to say that. Yep. It gets lonely.
Right. But they also don't know that each other is changing. You know, like they have to sort of make it safe for each other to change. It's one thing for, you know, one leader to have an epiphany that doing something differently is going to be helpful. But if that person is the only one doing it, that's risky. And I think one of our greatest challenges right now is how do we make it safe for senior leaders to have really honest conversations about what is happening? How do we make it safe for them to collectively be able to change and embrace new things together? And so that it feels safer for everyone else to begin to make significant change. I think these are big questions for us to dig into and explore.
Yeah, that's something that as we've been reimagining leadership development, I mean, it plays into this idea of collective development, that it's one thing to help a leader develop individually, but when they come together and they're sharing that journey and they're more vulnerable with each other about where they are growing and how can the collective support me, you know, so if I'm working on speaking up more and being more courageous in sharing my ideas, one of the things I can ask of my peer group is saying, if you notice me not speaking up, can you be sure to ask what's your perspective here? Because I'm working on developing this skill and I may need some prompts to get that started. And that would be a great way that you could help me if you notice me forgetting to do that. And as we've started to have those conversations, it's been really neat to watch in the pockets where we've been piloting some of this, how much they've really rallied in support of each other for the areas that they were wanting to develop, because now I'm part of your success too.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. And I hope that you're actually prompting them to give them a lot of positive feedback when they do it.
Yes, that's important.
I would sure that you are, but you know, I think if you take a risk and someone comes up and says, that was really fantastic, you know, even if it wasn't like perfect, it was like, I love that you did this, or it was really impactful that you did that. And that's what gives, you know, emboldens us to keep learning and trying and changing. So wow, sounds like you're doing some really beautiful work.
We're on a journey, you know, as it always is. We're on a journey, and but some of the things you're talking about are intentionally part of the design because we believe it's so important.
Yeah, beautiful, love it.
Any other like kind of practical examples of in the moment coaching you could share as we wrap up today?
Gosh, yes, so many. I guess if I was to leave people with some thoughts about how to take some of the things we've talked about and just kind of make them real for them now, I would say practice being curious. All right. One of the things we teach is that whatever people are doing, it makes perfect sense to them. And change and coaching begins when you actually get curious about the choices other people are making. So if you could just learn to stop before you move into judgment and get curious about what someone else is doing and why they might be choosing to do what they're doing, and ask yourself how you could support them to change, that would be a great way. And this could happen anywhere. It could happen in a meeting and someone's struggling. I have an example of someone who was leading change for a group of people, and they noticed that the people were like shutting down. And so they took a coaching approach to helping address the fear by telling them a story about how they had moved through a similar kind of change successfully. I mean, it's these little moments where we see fear starting to show up. If we greet it with a coaching approach of being curious and compassionate and courageously helping other people move through whatever they're having a reaction to, that's what literally like the grease that makes the change wheel move. So I don't know that if that was practical or not, but hopefully
I think it is. And it's also dovetails nicely with some work that we just did with our leaders about, you know, and fear is just another one of those emotions. But when emotion comes up in a conversation, sometimes we're uncomfortable greeting it. And so we just want to be like, it'll be okay. Or here's what you need to do instead so that we can squash it. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that we just recently helped our leaders is just how can you either acknowledge or normalize or just validate that it's understandable you would feel that way, or like others feel that way too. I've heard from others in the organization that they're having the same experience, mm-hmm. because that just starts to diffuse some of that. And it makes it okay for me to have the emotion, have the fear. There's no judgment in that, but it's how do I move forward from that and not just trying to suppress it or pretend like it doesn't exist and we can ignore it. Because I think sometimes, to your point of not feeling like we have the skills, we'd rather just ignore that because we feel unprepared to deal with it. And what you're describing is just another skill we have to lean into it.
Yes, exactly. You will discover that when you build those skills, those kind of coaching based in the moment skills that people step into and have the kinds of conversations they need to have to make any kind of change happen. And we've seen it over and over again. People will start coaching up. I mean, here's one of the things we discovered was we actually went and did a study where we asked people, you know, what kind of conversations were you having now that you didn't have before you learned, you know, how to untie knots? And what would you have done previously? And what stunned me was how many stories we got of people who finally coached up. Mm-hmm. They had been observing things not going well for a really long time, but they didn't know how to have the conversation with their leaders, you know, in an appreciative way to point towards what they saw the problem to be. But once they had the skill, you know, I heard over and over again of things that have been going wrong for a really long time changing because people finally kind of shared what they are observing because they felt safe not only to have the conversation, but to have it received.
That's awesome. Could use a lot more of that in the world, I think.
Again, that's unleashing potential, right? You know, it's like if you just give people the ability to safely have the conversation and say what they observe, you know, we can deal with things much more quickly and easily. So,
exactly. Well, would you be all right if I switched and asked you a question personally that we like to ask all of our guests?
Sure.
So we always are talking about what are you doing in your own leadership development? We talk about that being a journey that's never complete. So what are you working on as a leader for yourself right now?
Love that question. You know, we talked about coming out of the pandemic with, you know, kind of refreshed values, shall we say. For me, I just really came out with a compelling feeling I wanted to share this kind of work much more broadly. And so I actually just went through training to become a keynote speaker. And I'm looking at sort of changing how we've been doing something we call a dialogue to, you know, bring more voices in. So I'm really looking at ways of strengthening my voice in the world.
Well, congratulations. Good luck with that.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it's a little edgy, but you know, that's where the fun is, right?
Yeah, no, that's exciting to expand your platform and to be intentional about doing it with larger audiences and preparing yourself for that.
Yeah. So yeah, that's my edge.
Excellent. Thank you. Are you also game to play our rapid fire questions?
Of course.
Okay. All right. So the first one is a fill in the blank. Leadership is?
I'm realizing potential. I'm going to stick with that one.
Okay. And who is a leader you admire and why?
I really admire Oprah. I think she is the change she creates in the world. I think that she kind of built a whole business basically around bringing her vision of possibility into the world. And I think she's changed a lot of lives. So I think I love how she leads.
Great. Thank you. And what are you reading right now?
Well, I just picked up a new book. I hope I make it through. It's huge, but it's really cool, called The Master and His Emissary. And it's actually about the two different worldviews in our brain. I heard a really fantastic podcast, Hidden Brain, on One Head, Two Brains. And it was based off of this book. And it talks about the two worldviews of that your brain has, the left worldview and the right worldview, and how they kind of play together. And it is a huge piece, but it looks fascinating. So just getting into it.
All right. You'll have to give me an update, because one of our past guests recommended a book called The Hidden Spring, Ooh. Which is a super deep book. And it is so deep that I can only really read a few pages at a time. And it's about like kind of the hidden consciousness of our brain, but it is super deep and takes some time to understand. But it sounds like, just based on your description, that some of that may even be related to what's in that book as well. So
could be. I don't know. I'll let you know once I get into it.
Well, I'm not too far into The Hidden Spring either, because I have to keep putting it down and picking it up, and I'm always reading something else alongside of it. So
me too. Well, we'll just have to compare notes when we get done. And
yeah, I'd love to. I'm always looking for the next great book. That's why I asked the question. This is how I build my reading list, to be honest.
Great question. Yeah, I love it.
And the last one is, what do you love most about what you do?
Oh, what do I love most? You know, I think the things that touch me the deepest are when people share stories with me about how learning, you know, to take a, you know, untie knots has changed their lives and the lives of their families or the lives of the people that they meet. When I hear about how that turns into just practical change, kind of melts my heart, to be quite honest.
Yeah, I agree with you on that.
Yeah. Well, we, you know, all of us who live in this space of realizing potential, that's what keeps us going, I think.
Yeah. And it, I don't know. I mean, it shouldn't amaze me anymore, but it still never ceases to amaze me when, you know, especially within an organization, when you're teaching a skill set, you know, primarily related to helping people be better leaders. And to your point, you know, we hear as many or more testimonials about how it's impacted how they interact with their children, how they interact in their communities, how they interact with their partners. It's such a skill that transcends the work world and just makes you a better communicator, that it always is just a reminder and a refresher about the impact and the power of this work. Why coaching is such a fundamental skill.
Yes. Not only the power of the work, but the power of people when they use it.
Yes.
If I could just share one little note, because something that just happened to me recently, we opened up a digital platform to teach these skills. And one of the coolest things about it is, you know, it's moderated. So we get to watch as people learn. And recently I watched someone come in on the platform who really, truly had no idea what coaching was. And at the end of the program, which is just 4 weeks later, he actually wrote up his last coaching conversation as part of his assignment. And he actually had a conversation where he convinced someone to stop spewing hate online and actually take a more appreciative approach. I cried.
Yeah. Wow.
It's like, But, you know, when you empower people who have good intentions with the skills to bring them to life, that's what makes change happen. And we are so strong. We're so powerful. I think that all of us who are in the work of releasing that, you know, potential and power, I don't know, can just be emboldened to know that good people do good things when we empower them to do it.
That's a good way to end the podcast today with that message. So Diana, I thank you for engaging in this conversation with me and being a guest with us today. I learned a lot, and I know that our guests did too, our listeners. So thank you. And remember, everyone deserves to have a great leader. So keep working at being the best leader you can be. Until next time, thanks, Diana.
Thanks so much, Heather.
This podcast is an original production of Global Talent Management at Herman Miller Group. It's hosted by me, Heather Esposito, and produced in music by Sean Beck.